friends, and welcome to this edition of the Ames Tribune for Friday, February 26th, 2021. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And here is our first story. It's written by Philip Sitter. Edward Snowden to deliver Iowa State lecture on Gen Z and digital surveillance. Edward Snowden will give an Iowa State University lecture next week, speaking remotely from Russia to people watching a live stream on YouTube. Given Snowden's status as a former chief or a CIA officer and a National Security Agency consultant who leaked information about global surveillance programs and is living in exile in Moscow, it is no surprise his lecture will be given remotely. The added degree to which many Americans and people around the world live their lives remotely these days because of COVID-19 pandemic, university lectures included, heightens the topic of Snowden's lecture, Digital Surveillance, How Gen Z Gave Up Its Privacy to Corporations and the Government. The lecture will be live-streamed at 7 p.m. Thursday, March 4th, according to a news release from Iowa State's News Service. The link to the lecture is available through the news release and on the Iowa State Lecture Series YouTube channel. Snowden, in 2013, fled to Hong Kong with information on the U.S. government's digital surveillance systems and shared it with journalists. The subsequent Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting from The Guardian and The Washington Post publicly revealed how United States and cooperating spy agencies collected and mined phone and internet data in the name of counterterrorism operations. Snowden then fled to Russia, where he has been ever since. What was originally supposed to be a layover en route to Latin America before his passport was canceled. Former President Donald Trump said last year he considered pardoning Snowden, but he was ultimately not listed among a wave of pardons granted by Trump in the waning days of his administration. Snowden tweeted in a harshly critical statement on Trump that he was not disappointed to have gotten a pardon. In November, Snowden said he and his wife, an American who joined him in Russia, intended to apply for Russian citizenship without renouncing their American citizenship. The couple were also expecting a child, a boy, who was born in December. After years of separation from our parents, my wife and I have no desire to be separated from our son. That is why, in this era of pandemics and closed borders, we are applying for dual U.S.-Russian citizenship, he tweeted. Snowden had been granted permanent residence in Russia in October, and has previously said he would be willing to return to the United States if granted a fair trial for his leaks. He tweeted in January, "I would rather be without a state than without a voice." Snowden continues to speak out about technologies and practices that intersect with privacy and cybersecurity, according to Iowa State's news release on his lecture next week. There's not much more information than that immediately available on Snowden's lecture, though now the now dormant live stream link includes a quote of Snowden's on the screen. Quote, "I don't want to live in a world where everything I say, everything I do, everyone I talk to, every expression of creativity and love or friendship is recorded." Snowden authored the memoir, quote, "Permanent Record," unquote, autographed copies of which are available for sale at the Iowa State University bookstore. A federal court in September entered a judgment and an injunction against Snowden over profits from the book and specific lectures. Rather than stop publication and sales, the government sought to recover all proceeds earned by Snowden because of his failure to submit his publication for a pre-publication review in violation of his alleged contractual and fiduciary obligations. The court judged that Snowden owed the United States government more than $5 million for previous and further monies, royalties, or other financial advantages that Snowden would get from his memoir and 56 past speeches. The lawsuit was a civil case separate from the criminal charges against Snowden for leaking government information. Snowden's Iowa State lecture is sponsored by the National Affairs Lecture Series Committee and the Committee on Lectures, which is funded by student government, according to the university's news release. In addition to his book and the reporting on the surveillance revelations he brought forward, Snowden has also been the subject of the Academy Award-winning documentary Citizen 4 and a Hollywood feature film adaptation of his story entitled Snowden. The list of awards that he has received included in the Iowa State News release are the Right Livelihood Award, the German Whistleblower Prize, the Rheindauer Truth-Telling Prize, and the Carl Mann Oskitzi Medal from the International League for Human Rights. Snowden also serves as president of the Board of Directors of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. The board also includes Laura Poitras, director of Citizen 4, the movie, and Glenn Greenwald, one of the reporters who first covered the documents leaked by Snowden. Philip Sitter writes our next story. Pandemic adaptations may yield new learning options for future students, Ames' new special education director says. Adaptations made necessary during the COVID-19 pandemic may continue to offer Ames special education students new ways to be more involved in classrooms with their peers or access services at home, according to the district's new director of special education. The district announced earlier in February that Denny Thomas would start July 1st in the role, replacing Darcy Cousins, who is retiring. Thomas said she started working for the district in 2002 at Ames Middle School, her first teaching job, and has been in special education ever since. She is currently a special education and Title I coordinator, which is a job she has held since 2019. Before the pandemic hit last year, Thomas said a lot of this district's focus in special education was on Superintendent Jenny Reisner's commitments to more inclusion and equity, especially including students who have individualized education programs. We're still on that, Thomas said. That takes time to having kids really be in general education classes as much as they can be and interacting with their peers. She added, historically, a lot of times special education was treated like a place where we send kids, and that's something that we are working pretty hard as a district to move away from. Special education is not a location. It's not somewhere you send kids that learn differently or do things differently, but it's really a system of supports. The pandemic meant being forced to adapt special education services to school closures and then hybrid and remote learning models. And Thomas said, it really opened our eyes to how we can do an even better job of using technology to really maximize students' access and opportunity. There is no crisis wasted. There's an opportunity there to take some of the things we've learned how to do because we were forced to do them and continue to apply those things in the future. She said the district has seen how much more flexible it can be in providing special education services across the boundaries of buildings and classrooms, and that students can get in touch with experts. Thomas added that the video conferencing the district is using allows students to be in classrooms, having experiences with peers, even if they would not otherwise be ready to be physically in a classroom for any number of reasons, which I think is kind of a powerful thing moving forward. There has, however, been national concern during the pandemic that special education students, in particular, have lost ground with all the disruptions to school and service. Thomas said she's been monitoring Ames data over the past 6 months or so, and she is pleasantly surprised to see we're not seeing a huge amount of loss for a lot of kids. We've done some things to mitigate that, to make sure that we're having in-person sessions, that we're bringing kids into schools even when we're remote. Technology may also offer special education students some new opportunities with regard to recovering any lost progress. Thomas said the district recently started conversations about how to bring together recovery services and summer school, and she is thinking about how to deliver some summer school options remotely. She said that could be an interesting option for a lot of kids. Among her other priorities as incoming director, Thomas said she is interested in looking at new ways to use assistive technology. And one of the things that we're going to try really hard to work on is making sure that we're setting kids up to be independent. She added, I think it's really important that we set kids up with the tools and the resources that they need and to teach them how to use them so that they can be as independent as possible. Our next story is also written by Philip Sitter. Iowa State approved for bigger budget to upgrade poultry farm using industry support. The next steps for Iowa State University to continue to upgrade its turkey and chicken research facilities south of Ames got more lift this week from a combination of budget approval and private donations. In addition to a pedestrian bridge to Jack Trice Stadium, the Iowa Board of Regents also approved through consent agenda this week a project budget increase to grow the size of Iowa State's turkey facility and make improvements to its chicken facility. Two celebrity turkeys may also make a local appearance again this spring. Iowa ranks 7th in the United States for turkey production. It is the number one egg-producing state, and it processes 70% of the eggs produced in Iowa, according to university and industry sources. Iowa ranks 7th in U.S. turkey production and is the number one egg-producing state and processes 70% of the eggs produced in the state, according to university and industry sources. The Board of Regents in 2018 approved a budget of $5.7 million to consolidate Iowa State's 6 building chicken facility into one. The board in 2019 approved a further $1 million increase to build a turkey facility adjacent to the chicken facility. This week, a third revised budget was approved to grow to a total of $9 million in order to add more than 4,500 square feet to the proposed turkey facility for a total of 19,800 gross square feet and purchase state-of-the-art equipment for the chicken facility. Dan Thomason, professor and chairperson of the university's Department of Animal Science, said, "We have invested in these facilities to increase our opportunities teaching students on poultry, egg, and turkey health, welfare, and production as well. These facilities also replicate housing systems in the respective industries for us to improve bird health and welfare, food safety, sustainability, and more through basic and applied research. Our facilities are internationally renowned in these research areas, and it is awesome to build facilities to match the expertise to help Iowa's poultry, egg, and turkey producers," Thompson added. Iowa State's last March dedicated the Robert T. Hamilton Poultry Teaching and Research Farm, a nearly $7 million facility fully paid for with private funding. Likewise, with the turkey facility expansion, all funding for the construction of the facility has come from private gifts and donations from our stakeholders in the poultry, egg, and turkey industries, including the Iowa Poultry Association, the Iowa Egg Council, and the Iowa Turkey Federation, Thompson said. He added, "Farmers and producers across Iowa have also donated to these facilities with their hard-earned money to help Iowa State create a world-renowned training facility for tomorrow's producers, nutritionists, geneticists, and veterinarians for the poultry and turkey industries. Many companies that supply genetics, equipment, housing systems, and more have provided money and gifts in kind for our facilities. New equipment for the chicken facility that is budgeted in what the Board of Regents approved this week includes computerized feeding equipment and automated ventilation, as well as cooling controls, and additional biosecurity features, including controlled entrances and lockers, according to the project's description. The Iowa State University Foundation and the Animal Science Department also announced this week that several private gifts have been received to operationalize the pedigree room at the Robert T. Hamilton facility. A pedigree room is focused on breeding and genetics. The gifts included pedigree room pens from Germany-based Finage Poultry Solutions, which is a supplier of cage-free aviary equipment, and funds for penning installation from farm groups with Verosa, including Hawkeye Pride Farms, Center Fresh Farms, and Iowa Cage Free, Iowa-based shell and egg product suppliers for the further processed market. The further processed market includes uses for eggs and their shells beyond their unbroken form that consumers may find in grocery stores, on their restaurant plates, or within other products, such as liquid egg yolk or egg white, scrambled egg mix, hard-boiled eggs, food additives, cosmetics, as well as fertilizer. Added up, the contributions were worth $100,000. Poultry and egg production system provider Chore Time also donated hopper bottom bins that provide feed to the pedigree room, and Carson, Iowa-based Goodman Classic, an agricultural building constructor, donated insulation. Construction on the turkey facility is planned to begin this spring and continue through the fall of 2022, according to the project's description. Construction at the Iowa State Poultry Research Facilities may not be the only site to gander at this spring. The university has noted that people who missed seeing corn and cob in December should stay tuned and check back for more times in the spring. Corn and cob are two Iowa turkeys who competed to be pardoned last November by former President Donald Trump in an annual Thanksgiving tradition, with the pardoning bird also strutting away with the title of National Thanksgiving Turkey. Corn was the victor after winning 53.7% of a popular vote on Twitter. Both birds were born July 2, and Corn, appropriately enough to his namesake, was described as having sweet corn as his favorite snack, with Cobb partial to soybeans. You can meet Corn and Cobb and two birds vying for Trump's presidential turkey pardon on this website. Our next story is written by Rana Faborg. Scam caller posing as Story County Sheriff's Officer and demanding money, according to authorities. The Story County Sheriff's Office is cautioning residents that a man has been making scam phone calls. He is posing as a law enforcement official and demanding money. The caller identifies himself as Detective Aiden with the Story County Sheriff's Office. The scammer will advise the individual of a warrant out for their arrest due to noncompliance with sex offender registry laws, according to the news release. The scammer instructs the individual to go to purchase a specific money card from Walgreens to enable payment over the telephone. The scam call typically comes from a 515 area code. Captain Nicholas Lenny of Story County Sheriff's Office said it is not uncommon for scammers to use the actual names of personnel from the Sheriff's Office. However, there is no one by the name of Aiden who works at the Story County Sheriff's Office. We have received a number of calls in our dispatch office advising about this, Lenny said. Scammers tend to prey on people who are more vulnerable and may fall to those types of calls. The caller threatens warrants and action and demands money. The sheriff's office, will never call people up and demand money. If there is a warrant out for your arrest, we are not going to call you on the telephone and demand money in lieu of being arrested for it. The sheriff's office reminds the public to be aware anytime a caller asks for payment or personal information. Be suspicious. Scammers will often pose as someone you would trust, such as a family member, a bank, or a law enforcement official. Do not trust the caller ID number. With current technology, it is common for a scammer to make it appear that the call is from a legitimate number. If you believe you have a call that is a scam, tell local law enforcement. Report the scam. The sheriff's office also suggested that telephone scams can be reported to the Federal Trade Commission online at ftc.gov/complaint. For more information on how to report and block unwanted numbers, the FTC offers guidance online. You should hang up and call back. If a caller identifies themselves as being from the Story County Sheriff's Office, you're not sure about it, Lenny said you should hang up and call the Sheriff's Office at the non-emergency number. The Sheriff's Office non-emergency number is 515-382-6566. Slow down. Scammers will pressure you to make decisions in a hurry, and they might even threaten you. Call someone you trust or do an online search before giving out any information or money. We're really just encouraging people to not be pressured or rushed by the call and to take some time to figure it out, Lenny said. We wanted to get this information out there to alert people and hopefully prevent anybody from becoming a victim of this scam. Our next story comes to us from the Des Moines Register. Iowa is launching a new site and a phone line to help eligible people get the COVID-19 vaccine. Here is how they will work. Iowa will launch a new website Friday telling residents eligible for a COVID-19 vaccination where they might be able to find one. The site will not schedule appointments or register people for a waiting list, but it may make it easier to match people to available shots. That according to Governor Reynolds at a news conference on Thursday. The website is vaccinate.iowa.gov. vaccinate.iowa.gov. She also announced that the state is assembling a team to help schedule vaccinations for Iowans that are 65 years of age and older who have difficulty navigating the process. The team will be available through the state's 211 hotline beginning March 8. It will be exclusive to those Iowans. That is a telephone number 211. It is a hotline, and it will be open beginning March 8. In the meantime, the team members are reaching out directly to Iowans identified by area agencies on aging as needing help. The team will not ask for personal information like Social Security numbers, health insurance status, or bank or credit card numbers, and Iowans should be wary of any person who calls to ask for that information or comes to your door to ask for that information, Reynolds said. Iowa will not be pursuing a centralized scheduling website for vaccination appointments or registration to alert people when they become eligible, Reynolds said. She announced last week that the state canceled a contract with Microsoft to develop such a system because it would potentially disrupt the state's pandemic response. The new website will serve as a one-stop shop of available vaccine providers, Reynolds said. People will be able to input their zip code and see vaccination providers in their area that have appointments available, similar to the service offered by the federal government, she said. The United States CDC is supporting that website. It is vaccinefinder.org. Our next story is written by Rana Faborg. The Ames Library reopens to visitors on March 15th. Things are moving one step closer to normal at Ames Public Library as it prepares to reopen for browsing March 15th. At that time, visitors will be able to access the collections on the first and second floors. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the library closed a little under a year ago on March 20th, along with other city buildings. In the months since, the library has offered curbside service, especially during times when Story County was a hotspot for the virus. Ames Public Library opened its lobby July 1st for limited hours and services such as picking up reserved materials or getting a grab-and-go kit. Library staff will be available to answer basic reference and account questions, a news release stated. Computers will continue to be available for 30-minute sessions. Some areas of the library remain closed during this phase, including play areas, study rooms, and meeting rooms. Visitors should limit their time in the building to 30 minutes so others can use the facility safely, the news release said. Visitors must wear masks covering their nose and their mouth and maintain 6 feet of distance from staff and other visitors. Visitors are asked not to eat or drink in the library at this time. For visitors who would still like to make a quick in-and-out visit, the library will continue to have some of its popular features available in the lobby. The library has Quick Picks, which is a selection of popular titles that are on hand in the lobby for fast, convenient checkout. There are also grab-and-go bags of pre-selected books or movies on various topics, genres, or reading levels. At-home activity kits are take-home kits with a new theme each week. Past themes included puzzles and games, and flight, and wheel and axle, which corresponded to videos available on the library's website. Ames Public Library's open hours will remain Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, as well as Saturday from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., Tuesday and Thursday from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., and Sundays from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. The library staff and the Board of Trustees will continue to monitor the situation and collaborate with city officials and health experts to adapt library services as needed, according to the news release. For more information, you can visit the Ames website. It is www.amespubliclibrary.org/COVID, that's all in capital letters, COVID, capital letters, 19. Our next story is titled 14 New COVID-19 Cases Reported in Story County Between Wednesday and Thursday. An additional 14 new COVID-19 cases were confirmed in Story County from Wednesday to Thursday. The state's coronavirus website showed at 10 a.m. on Thursday. No new deaths were reported. At that time, state officials reported 9,469 positive cases in Story County, up from Wednesday's total of 9,455. To date, a total of 45 Story County residents have died as the result of COVID-19, according to the Iowa Coronavirus website. Of those who have tested positive for the virus in Story County, 8,862 individuals have recovered. As of Thursday, the Story County 14-day average positivity rate is 3.7%, down from 3.8% on Wednesday. Across the entire state of Iowa, an additional 652 positive cases of the virus were reported, and 23 deaths were reported Thursday morning. At 10 a.m. Thursday, the state was reporting that there are 334,700 confirmed cases of coronavirus, an increase of 652 since 10 a.m. on Wednesday. Isabel Rosario writes our next story. Ames homicide victim called an absolute sweetheart. Renea Bell was the type to get reluctant people on the dance floor. At an Ames high school prom, a lot of us did not do the whole dancing thing, Eric Range recalled, but she found a way to get the ones that didn't want to dance up and actually dance and have some fun. Long after graduation, Bell was still definitely the life of the party, and she enjoyed making spontaneous plans to go out to downtown bars, according to her friend Jamie Peters. Nikki Deal introduced Bell and Peters when the three were in seventh grade. They all grew apart as life happened, Deal said, but still they kept in touch occasionally. Any time that I was with her, it was like no time had passed, Deal said. Police found Bell, age 37, dead in her Ames apartment Saturday night while performing a welfare check. Bell's boyfriend, Richard Fleck, age 33, has been charged with the first-degree murder. Police have said the death was caused by blunt force trauma. Fleck had been staying with Bell for about a month and is now believed to be in Kansas City, Missouri, but also has ties to communities in Texas and Mississippi, according to the police. Bell was an optician at Wiley Eye Care Center. She attended Ames High School and Des Moines Area Community College, where she studied to become a certified nursing assistant, according to her Facebook page. Range said Bell was an absolute sweetheart. When things were going bad for people, she was there to talk to them. Range said no matter what the situation was, she wanted to be there to help you through whatever issues you were going through at the time. Peters echoed that sentiment, saying Bell was the kind of person who would literally just drop everything for a person in need. Bell was just as fun-loving as she was loyal, her friend said. Deal fondly remembers her high school friend group clowning around in class. Supposed to be learning, but not really paying attention, she had one of those laughs that was just absolutely infectious, Deal said. All living a couple of blocks from each other as kids, Peters and Deal said it was hard to pinpoint specific memories of their friend with whom they spent so much time. They spent summers swimming at the city pool, having sleepovers, going to movies, and walking around their neighborhood. As teenagers, they drove around and blasted Britney Spears music through their speakers. Any time I hung out with her was really a good memory, Deal said. Peter said Beale's death comes as even more of a shock because another woman in their close-knit high school friend group recently died of cancer. She was really close to Renee, so now I'm just sitting here thinking, well, now they're together, Peter said. It's just strange. Now Renee is gone too. Our next story comes to us from Brent Van Wass. The Colonesco School District announced on February 11th the hiring of Mark Snavely to serve as the new superintendent and elementary principal. Snavely, formerly serving as the secondary principal at Wilton, Iowa, as well as an elementary teacher before that, emerged from a field of 17 candidates who applied for the job. The interview team felt Snavely's experience in an elementary setting and in rural schools made him an ideal choice for the job. Current part-time superintendent Jim Walker will assist Snavely in settling into his new role until he officially begins his contract on July 1st. When the position was advertised, I thought, this was a perfect opportunity for myself and my family, Snavely said in a news release from the district. After interviewing on February 9th, it became evident that this was the right fit. Snavely and his family plan to move to the area this summer. Director of Grounds and Maintenance updated the board once again in the most recent meeting on construction projects throughout the district, though progress has been slowed because of waiting on materials and sub-zero weather. Removal of ductwork and insulation continues at the Colo building. Lytle also relayed to the board that Graphite Construction has notified the district and ISG that because of a delay in the steel joist framing and decking delivery, substantial completion of the project will be 86 days past the original completion date schedule. The completion date is now projected by Graphite to be November 10th of 2021. The board pointed out that the following areas should be prioritized and need to be completed prior to school starting as scheduled in August. The kitchen, cafeteria, and the gymnasium at Zeering, as well as getting the HVAC system up and running in Colo. The first day of school is scheduled for Thursday, August 26, 2021, with the last day scheduled is May 27th, 2022. Winter break will be December 23rd through January 3rd, with spring break scheduled between March 14 to 18, and graduation slated for May 22. The board also continued to review their return to learn plans as relates to COVID-19 protocols. It was decided that the district will keep current policies in place until staff have received the second dose of vaccine. The board will continue to monitor the situation at each meeting. Later, a public hearing was set for 6:30 p.m. April 12th in ICN room at the Colo site. Business manager Brian Schaefer will present the district's fiscal year 22 budget for comment with board action following the public hearing. A resolution to renew the district's instructional support levy, or ISL, will also be presented at this meeting. The current ISL, funded fully by property tax, is a maximum of 10% of the district's regular program cost and pays for staff, materials, and educational supplies. The 21-22 school year's ISL is estimated at $315,600. In other news, the board approved $8,150 for replacement of lights in the vocational agricultural shop, $4,400 for a 3-year lease with Van Wall for 3 mowers and a Gator ATV, a pay application from Graphite Construction Group for $302,501, and $30,992 to Push Pedal Pull for replacing the weight racks and the benches. Quotes for new floor mats in the weight room will likely be discussed at the March meeting. Also approved was an Impact Teen Club program in conjunction with Youth and Shelter Services. This will be an after-school program for students in 6th, 7th, and 8th grades until around 5 p.m., and the program was set to begin February 22. The board approved sharing agreements with neighboring districts, including continuing an agreement for boys and girls soccer with Baxter, Colfax Mingo, Collins Maxwell, and West Marshall for the 2021 season. The board also approved sharing the following positions and services with Nevada, school business manager, transportation director, human resources director, and curriculum director. Also purchased were technology support from Nevada at $35,000 and a one-time for library support. The next regular school board meeting will be held Monday, March 15 at 6:30 p.m. at the McCallsburg Elementary Cafeteria. You are listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Pre-Handicapped. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and it is time for us to turn to the obituaries. Patricia Ann Redlinger, age 67, of Iowa City, passed away beautifully and peacefully at her home on Monday, February 22, surrounded by love. A private service will be held at 11 o'clock in the morning on Thursday, March 4th. Services will be live streamed on the Jones and Eden Funeral Home Facebook page. Per her wishes, Pat's body was deeded to the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine for scientific purposes. Interment will be held at Elm Grove Cemetery at a later date. The Jones and Eden Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. To send an online condolence or to view the full obituary, please visit www.jonesfh.com. Pat is survived by five sisters, Nancy and Frank Rezabek of Columbia, Missouri, Marcia and Joe Parker of Ottumwa, Iowa, Carol and Jeff Hoyle of Washington, Iowa, Fran and Kevin Audie of Clive, Iowa, and Rhonda Redlinger of Washington, Iowa, as well as nieces and nephews, Jason and Justin Nardi, Josh and Megan Hoyle, Jennifer Johnson and Grant Ross, and Kyle Audie. And here's the non sequitur comic for today. A gentleman has arrived at the pearly gates to heaven. St. Peter is there up on his podium. He's got his book and his pen in his hand. He's, you know, listing the names of people and who gets in and who doesn't. And there is a dog and a cat going straight through. They don't even stop to talk to St. Peter. They're just going straight through the pearly gates, straight into heaven, a dog and a cat. The man, however, has to wait because they're checking his name. And the man asks St. Peter, why does the cat and the dog go straight in? And St. Peter says, because they put up with people their entire life. That's why they get a free pass. Next, we have the coronavirus news briefing. Pfizer BioNTech will begin testing a booster shot to combat COVID-19 variants, the company's announced on Thursday, one day after new research published in the New England Journal of Medicine confirmed that the two doses of the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine cut symptomatic COVID-19 cases across all age groups by 94%. Now, the two-company collaboration has asked 144 volunteers who participated in the earliest phase of its clinical trials last year to volunteer again to receive the booster, a third shot of the same vaccine designed to see whether it will help them fight off new, more infectious variants that have been circulating in recent months. It's not yet clear whether a new vaccine or a booster will be needed to address the known variants, but companies want to be prepared if studies show a new vaccine is needed. The United States has more than 28 million confirmed coronavirus cases, 506,000 deaths, according to Johns Hopkins University. More than 88 million vaccine doses have been distributed in the U.S., and about 66 million have been administered, according to the CDC. Next in the series, two preliminary studies have identified a new variant called B1.5.2.6 in New York, although neither study has been through critical or crucial peer review. Michael Nossingswig, an immunologist at Rochester University who was not involved in the new research, told the New York Times that while the discovery is not welcome news, just knowing about it is good because we can perhaps do something about it. Others have questioned releasing information so early in the vetting process. Nathan Grubaugh, a public health professor at Yale University, tweeted that he was asked to provide comment on someone's draft manuscript that still had tracked changes and did not include the figures. This is an absolute mess, Dr. Jay Varma, public health advisor to Mayor de Blasio, tweeted in a plea to academics, please review high-impact studies, government health departments, before making it to the media. Next in the series, Americans should not try to pick and choose which vaccine they get, but should take the first one available, that according to Dr. Anthony Fauci on Thursday. He warned people not to hold off getting the one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine, if it soon becomes available, while waiting for the slightly more effective Pfizer or Moderna shots. Fauci also told NBC News a third vaccine becoming available is nothing but good news. Johnson & Johnson's vaccine offers strong protection against severe COVID-19, Fauci said. It is a race between the virus and getting vaccines into people. And the longer people wait, the better chance the virus has to get a variant or a mutation. In other headlines in this series, the incidence of Bell's palsy, a condition that can cause temporary facial paralysis, was 3.5 to 7 times higher among those who received the Pfizer, BioNTech, or Moderna vaccines in clinical trials than in the general population. That according to a study in the journal Lancet. The study calls for robust surveillance, but notes Bell's palsy usually self-resolves, and vaccines offer a substantial net benefit to health. Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press. New York woman loses her job and leaves. New York woman loses her job, leads pantry feeding thousands. The story comes to us from New York. While dozens of New Yorkers lined up outside in the rain, shopping carts at the ready, as they waited for free food, Sophia Mocayo led her team in prayer. "We're super grateful for these people here. In Jesus' name we pray," she said. And the group of women around her clapped, cheered, and replied, "Amen." "Now," she said, "let's get to work." By then, they had worked almost nonstop for hours. They picked up heavy boxes, they separated thousands of items, and they removed snow from the curb. They were cold, they were wet, and they were tired. No one would pay them, and they did not care. They were just happy to be there for someone else that day. During the coronavirus pandemic, Mocayo has led the food distribution program through Mosaic West Queens Church in the Sunnyside neighborhood. The initiative began in March. Mocayo took charge a month later as it expanded to serve hundreds of people. Since then, Mocayo has had her own struggles. She was furloughed from her job at a construction company, and she remains unemployed, and she owes 5 months of rent for the martial arts studio that she owns with her husband in the neighborhood. But she has continued to lead fundraisers and coordinate dozens of volunteers who distribute more than 1,000 boxes of food to families 2 times every week. "I think helping others has to do something to your brain chemically, because if we had not been doing everything that we were doing, I think this would have been a much scarier time," she said. "Being able to dig in and help others, it really gives you perspective, and it helps you believe that you are going to be okay too. Most of the food is donated by a neighborhood restaurant and other sources. There's also been help from the Farmers to Families Food Box Program, which is overseen by the United States Department of Agriculture." Mocayo, who was born in Colombia, was moved to volunteer by her Christian faith, by memories of the food insecurity she faced growing up in New York. She recalled how she would join her family in lines to pick up bread and cheese from pantries, and how sometimes she felt shame. "One of the things that we wanted to make sure is that we do not look at people on the pantry line as people that need food, and really focus on, hey, these are our neighbors." Sunnyside resident Carol Sullivan lost her stage manager job when Broadway theaters closed because of the virus. She was hesitant at first about receiving food from a pantry, but she said that Mocayo and other volunteers made her feel welcome. "It has been a link to the community that I did not have before, and it also saves a lot of anxiety over having to have money to pay for food, over having to pay for the bills," Sullivan said. "If you have a dollar, you have to stretch it in so many places. Having them has made the choice less stressful." Our next story comes to us from the Anchorage Daily News, Anchorage, Alaska. Thunderstorms frequency could triple in Alaska by the end of the century because of ongoing climate change, according to new research. Big thunderstorms, the kind that produce lots of rain, are not common in Alaska now. Some 30 occur in the state every year, according to Andreas Prien, a research scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, who worked on the 2 papers published in Climate Dynamics. But the papers say melting sea ice could lead to more frequent thunderstorms across the state, with potentially devastating effects such as heavier rainfall and flash flooding, landslides, and more wildfires sparked by lightning. The consequences could be manifold, Prien said. The cause of the more frequent thunderstorms is linked to a continued loss of sea ice in the Arctic Ocean, according to the research. Sea ice caps keep water below it from evaporating, essentially sealing it in. But as that ice continues to recede, larger tracts of ocean will be uncovered, which could lead to more moisture in the atmosphere and over Alaska. That moisture feeds thunderstorms, Priyan said. The greatest increase in frequency of storms is likely to occur in the central part of the state, Priyan said. But also alarming is the potential in certain places like parts of the North Slope that do not get thunderstorms to begin seeing them as well, according to Maria Molina, a research scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research who worked on the second study. It's important to not get hung up on the exact number of storms that could occur, said Andrew Newman, project scientist with the National Center for Atmospheric Research, who worked on the first of the two papers. Rather, the research shows that such extreme events are likely to happen more frequently. There might be a year where you see a thunderstorm for the first time, and then you might get one the next year, and then all of a sudden, you're realizing that that's kind of the new normal, Newman said. One consequence of increased thunderstorms that should be studied more is the increased risk of wildfires due to lightning strikes, Newman said. Typically, the lightning that starts wildfires is associated with dry thunderstorms. So thunderstorms that don't have a lot of rain, Newman said. Whether or not those conditions exist or will exist in the future in Alaska, we did not necessarily look at that specifically in our studies. The predictions have the potential to impact several parts of life in Alaska, from small aviation to housing design, according to Rick Thomas, climate specialist at the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy, who did not work on this study. So what does this mean to Alaskans? Certainly, one of the core messages in this set of papers is that thunderstorms have the potential to become much more intense than thunderstorms are now, with much more rain in short periods of time, and those frequencies of those extreme rain events could increase quite dramatically, Thorman said. Whether Alaska is already seeing more frequent thunderstorms is hard to say, Thorman said. While there is anecdotal evidence of more storms, there isn't consistent data. Newman, with the National Center for Atmospheric Research, said the studies point to the importance of continuing to discuss human-caused climate change and its potentially costly consequences to Alaska in detail. To me, it's a call to action, Newman said, and to say that we need to figure out what we are going to do. Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press. China celebrates the official end of extreme poverty, and it lands Xi. The ruling Communist Party is celebrating the official end of extreme poverty in China with a propaganda campaign that praises President Xi Jinping's role. Part of efforts to cement his image as a history-making leader who is reclaiming his country's rightful place as a global power. The propaganda apparatus has been linking national successes to Xi, including fighting the coronavirus, China's rise as a technology creator, and December's successful lunar mission to bring back moon rocks. The party announced in November, with little fanfare, that China no longer had anyone in extreme poverty. That was down from an official estimate of almost 99 million living on annual incomes of less than 2,300 yuan, which is the equivalent of $355 per person one decade ago. The full-scale propaganda campaign launched this month has filled state-controlled newspapers and airwaves with reports on the anti-poverty milestone and Xi's personal role in it. They credit Xi, Xi is spelled, by the way, with capital X-I, with launching an initiative shortly after taking power in 2012 that enabled China to beat by a decade the 2030 budget target set by the World Bank for eliminating extreme poverty. A report by the party newspaper People's Daily this week on the historical leap refers to Xi by his full name and title as party leader 121 times. General Secretary Xi Jinping has stood at the strategic height of building a well-off society in an all-around way and realizing the Chinese dream of the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, the newspaper said. The event gives the ruling party a political trophy ahead of this year's celebration of the 100th anniversary of its 1921 founding. It comes at a time when China's economy is growing again following the coronavirus, while the United States, Europe, and other areas are still struggling with outbreaks. The party said it reached the milestone despite having to take the unprecedented step of shutting down most of China's economy in 2020 to fight the coronavirus. On Thursday, she cited anti-poverty work as a sign of the effectiveness of the ruling party system. "We have finished the arduous task of eradicating absolute poverty and created a miracle that shall go down in history," she said at a ceremony honoring people who worked on the initiative. She presented medals and certificates and plaques to 10 individuals and 10 groups honored as anti-poverty role models. He acknowledged the material foundation built up over four decades of market-style reforms that have transferred China into the world's second-largest economy and a middle-income society, but mentioned no other officials or earlier leaders by name. The event gives Xi, who has amassed more personal power than any leader since Mao Zedong, communist Chinese founder, a new opportunity to assist his historical importance. Abroad, Xi is pursuing an assertive foreign policy that has increased China's diplomatic influence, but roiled relations with its neighbors and with the United States and Europe. The poverty milestone gives Xi ammunition to shore up power that some foreign analysts suggested was eroded by the coronavirus outbreak, which began in the central city of Wuhan in late 2019. Anti-poverty campaigns also are aimed at narrowing the politically volatile gulf between an elite who have profited most from economic reform and the poor majority. Xi's predecessor, Hu Jintao, and then Premier Wen Jiabao started that process by stepping up spending on rural schools and healthcare to spread prosperity from thriving export-powered East Coast. China's official definition of extreme poverty is an income per person of 11 yuan, or $1.70 a day. That is lower than the World Bank standard of $1.90 a day. But the National Bureau of Statistics says that due to differences in rural living costs, the Chinese standard is slightly higher. In some areas, low-income ethnic minority communities have been moved out of remote valleys into newly built towns. In others, officials went door to door, signing up poor families for job training, grants to start businesses, and other aid. Nearly 10 million people moved into new homes, and those of 27 million more have been renovated, according to Xi. He said the government has spent a total of $1.6 trillion, or the equivalent of $250 billion. Average income per person among the rural underprivileged rose from 2,982 yuan, or $356 US, to 10,740 yuan, or $1,665 US last year, according to the official Xinhua news agency. Our next story is titled Senator Grassley will make re-election decision in the fall. Republican United States Senator Charles Grassley said Wednesday he expects to make a decision about whether to seek re-election sometime in September, October, or November of this year. "That's plenty of time to make up my mind," he said on a call with reporters. "And in the meantime, I have a job working for Iowans. I love my work, and I am working hard." Previously, he had said a decision might be coming within several weeks. Grassley has been at the center of growing speculation as Iowa's Republicans and Democrats alike wonder whether the 87-year-old senator will seek an eighth term in office. Those questions have only grown more pronounced as other Republican senators announce they will not seek re-election, potentially creating openings for Democrats who would not have to run against incumbents. They include Senators Rob Portman of Ohio, Richard Burr of North Carolina, and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. Grassley, who won his 2016 election by 24 points, would present a formidable challenge for Democrats looking to claw back congressional power after a round of losses in 2020. So far, no Democrats have said they will run for the United States Senate in 2022. State Senator Jim Carlin, a Republican from Sioux City, has said he will run whether Grassley seeks an eighth term or not. Grassley said he did not have any comments on Carlin's candidacy because everybody's got the right to run for any office they want to as long as they meet the constitutional requirements. He said that despite his age, he would be 95 at the end of another six-year term. He has the physical capacity to seek re-election. This morning, I got up at 4 a.m., like I do six times a week, and I jogged 2 miles, he said. And if I can do that every day, I hope nobody has any questions about my ability to conduct a campaign. It will be up to the voters to decide whether or not I should be re-elected, but I hope they will not say, I cannot conduct a campaign. And that brings us to the conclusion of reading the Ames Tribune for this Friday, February 26, 2021. Your reader today has been Dave Sauerman. Thank you for listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped.